Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to what is the first and hopefully an ongoing series of Q&A editions of the Curzon Film Podcast. After a recent screening of Luca Guadagnino's phenomenal Call Me By Your Name at Curzon Soho, we were lucky enough to welcome regular Five Live film contributor and Telegraph film critic Robbie Collin to host a conversation with Luca, along with the film's lead actors Timothy Chalamet and Armie Hammer. For insights into the film's location, music, and just how high those short shorts went, do stay tuned. If you're just joining us on the podcast, don't forget to subscribe, as next week we have Greta Gerwig coming on the show to talk about Lady Bird, and we've just released episodes on foreign language Oscar nominee Loveless, Paul Thomas Anderson's Phantom Thread, and a special conversation with Bottom and now Star Wars own Ade Edmondson about joining the Royal Shakespeare Company for Twelfth Night. But now it's time to pass over to the wonderful crowd at Curzon Soho and your host, Robbie Collin.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming along to today's special Q&A screening of Call Me By Your Name. It gives me enormous pleasure to welcome to the stage director Luca Guadagnino and Timothy Chalamet and Armie Hammer. Congratulations all on the film. I gather you've just arrived here from the premiere in Paris, so there are people around the world who are still seeing this for the first time. While the final scene is still, you know, in the air, let's talk about that, because Timothy, I wonder, when you're playing a moment like that, where did that fall in the shooting schedule? Were you able to draw on things that you'd already played, or was that something that came
quite early? That's absolutely the case. We shot that scene maybe 3 days from the end of the movie. The scene that we shot precedent to the last scene in the film is the scene with the father. So I shot that scene with Michael Stuhlbarg, who plays Mr. Perlman, and that scene obviously has a very, I don't know, maybe nostalgic's not the right word, but certainly, vaguely emotional charged scene. So when it came time to do that last scene, is that our first AD right there? No. Nope. Never mind. Nope. She's not making a face, so I'm just pointing to a random person. And then when it came time to do it, it was like living the nostalgia of the moment and what we had just experienced and getting to work with Luca and Armie for a month and a half.
And there's this particular detail in that scene. It's like this kind of magical occurrence, the fly that buzzes into shot. I don't know if people spotted this. Certainly on my second time of the film, this became, and there's something incredible about that moment, and obviously you could have used a take where there was no fly, but you used the fly.
I mean, after such an effort in directing the fly.
It wasn't CG, was it? It was the real
fly. No. It's a fly.
What, I mean, this is characteristic of all your work, but I think specifically in this film, Luca, you have kind of left the door open to the real world coming into every scene.
And I was lucky with the fly, because the truth is that in these countryside homes, I'm sure it's the same here in the UK, in the winter sometimes you find an insect like a fly trying to survive the winter. And it was an accident, but a lovely metaphor for Elio.
Armie, I want to ask you about playing the phone call in that final scene as well. Your character's declaration, "I remember everything," seems to sum up, because the book is written mainly in flashback. The main relationship is all in flashback, whereas, of course, in the film it's present tense. But that seems to capture something of the essence of what the original novel does. And I wonder if you could tell us about playing that scene, because, I mean, were you even present for it, or did you record it a separate time?
No, I was there. I was about maybe 10, 15 feet away. I was just around a corner, actually, on a phone, if I remember correctly, right? They were...
Yeah, you were upstairs in the green room.
Oh, that's right.
And he was downstairs.
That's right, that's right. So I was, you know, just one staircase away. And I remember just getting on the phone, and we just had, because there was no camera there, because there was no one around, because it was just me on a phone alone in a room, it felt... Because we did really shoot it towards the end of the movie. It was kind of like one of the penultimate things, except for his scene at the fireplace, from my character anyway. It felt incredibly authentic to just be on the phone away from the set talking about how I remember everything, because it was such a magical experience getting to make this film, and such a beautiful experience working with Luca and working with Timmy. So it was also really funny because they would call cut and then I would just sit there for like 5 or 10 minutes and be like, hello? And be like, yeah, shh, shh, we're setting it up, we're setting it up. I go, okay, and then I wait. Action. They go, oh, okay, when this phone's on. And then they call cut, and I just wait again. But it was great.
How did you both go about sounding out Oliver and Elio's chemistry? Because it seems, you know, to me that there seems to be this element of, obviously there's the attraction between them, but there's this kind of fraternal bond as well. And there's kind of an element of mentorship too. It's a complicated relationship. Where did that come from? Were there preliminary discussions with Luca, or how did you build that?
There were a lot of conversations with Luca. We spent a lot of time sitting around his kitchen table, eating delicious food, drinking delicious wine, and talking about a beautiful script, which in and of itself was a rewarding experience. But then also, they brought Timmy out about 4 weeks before I came, and really just familiarized him with the town and with the place, and he was taking the piano lessons and working on his Italian, and I mean, his French is flawless, but he was really kind of, you know, ingratiating himself into the town. So then I showed up about 3 or 4 weeks before we started filming, and Luca, you know, as part of his genius, just said, okay, you guys don't talk about anything, get on bicycles and just go right around the town. Timmy, show him around. And we spent weeks riding around the town. He would say, that's where you get a good cup of coffee, that's where you get the great pizza, that's a great gelato shop. And we just really had the luxury of time without feeling any pressure or any sort of hurried sense of, you know, we have to get ready for this. He gave us the luxury, you know, that you can feel in the movie, where just everything is allowed to take its time. And he gave us time to get to know each other. And as Timmy says, I think it's just one of the luck of the universe things where we just genuinely liked each other. And we really enjoyed the time that we got to spend together.
And we were on a bike ride one day, and I said to him, you know, if only you knew how little I know about the things that matter. And he said, what things that matter? I said, you know what things I'm talking about.
So, Luca, does that replace rehearsal for you, or is that something that happens in tandem with rehearsal? I mean, running lines.
Well, I see the rehearsal as a theatrical process, and I did direct theater a few times, opera, and I enjoyed that very, very much, and I see that as a very specific part of the stage direction, which I see as a different kind of job of mine. And so I just don't see it. Like, I don't understand. Because it's not immediacy that you strive for when you direct. It's something a bit more different. It's try to make them open in a way that it's not just the lines and the enacting of the lines and the perfecting of those lines' pronunciation that counts. And it's not even simply the blocking, but it's the capacity of disappearing and reappearing, both as actors and people, into the characters. And that happens to be only if there is a confidence and a trust between the people involved. And so I think the answer is yes.
Just on that point with the nosebleed scene specifically, that struck me as a moment where that approach seemed to really pay off, because, you know, you guys, the chemistry between you, it feels like it's not being overthought, it just kind of happens naturally. I mean, how much of the interactions between the two of you were scripted. And
for which scene?
The nosebleed scene, when you retreat indoors and then you kind of hide down behind the counter.
I don't know, it seemed like the gift of getting to act in a lot of wide shots that, you know, the relationship could be communicated physically and as like a dance of sorts and a push and pull as opposed to with dialogue. And that's a great joy, too, to work with great dialogue. But this is, I think, as an audience member, I always like this better, moments of spontaneity. And, the scene you referenced, I think, was actually pretty strictly blocked, actually, because we had to get the ice. And that was one of the more difficult scenes to find where the camera went, if I remember correctly. Maybe one of two on the shoulder shots in the movie. But
yeah, because it's a tiny
little room. But for, I mean, I don't know. It was like Luca really gave us a lot of room to play. And knowing that, like, not as crassly as, like, thinking that it all had to be subtle, but knowing just the tone of Luca's movies and how subtle and refined the performances are, I know I had the freedom feeling like, okay, I can try crazy stuff from take to take or come in and out of frames. And I'm sure there's a lot of artificial moments in that, but they just didn't make them into the movie because there was the room to play and mess up and then find those moments more organically.
Just on the point of finding camera placement, this film was all shot with one lens, right? It was all 35mm, and that was the end of it. Why would you choose to work like that, particularly when you've got this house that has so many kind of romantic little nooks and crannies in it that would make shooting with, you know, this wide variety of lenses much much easier on the day?
Well, because I've been using the means in a way that have been always very prominent, and I felt in this case for a movie that didn't originate from me, meaning that I did not thought of making this movie when I read the book in the first place. I became the director very, very down the line. I started to think more and more that maybe there was a way in which the characters were the driving force of the film, also in terms of the language of the film. And I had the privilege of meeting once the great Canadian maestro David Cronenberg, and he told me that he usually uses one lens. And I was like, really? And I remember Fassbinder does 35. And he spoke to me about the way he uses one lens. Usually they use with Suchitsky's DP a wide lens like 24. And then I spoke to my DP and I said, let's make some tests and see what do we feel is the most adherent lens to the general look of the film. And that's how we picked the 35. And it was a very freeing experience for all of us because we had one camera, one lens. We didn't have to think anymore about that. And there was not this medium. But in a way, it's a sort of empowerment of cinema, probably.
Let's talk a bit about the locations that come out looking so incredible on that lens. Because the original book wasn't located in Crema, right? It was set
in Liguria on the seafront.
Yes, right. And then James Ivory's initial adaptation
was
of
set
the script
in Sicily.
Yes. So why
James couldn't understand how we could have Roman refindings in the north of Italy.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And I had to explain him that there was findings in the north of Italy, but I didn't convince him until he saw the film eventually.
The fact of the matter is Luca also lives in Crema, so there was that added convenience.
Yeah, that was a very good convenience.
How big a part did the actual house itself play in deciding to shoot in Crema, though? Because the house is like, specifically...
I knew the house. I'd seen the house before, and I thought it was very good in terms of the geography of the house, the two rooms communicating to one another. I like the idea that it looked, in a way, old and established, but yet was crumbling and deprived. It communicated to me in a way that was immediate what kind of family could have been the Perlmans. And the countryside around reminded me a lot of Bertolucci's Pianura Padana, actually the same, it's the same region. And so all these things, along with the sleeping in my bed, went together into my decision.
And there's that fantastic sequence when you're both out cycling and stop off for a drink of water at this country house, and then up on the wall above the doorway, there's a photograph of Benito Mussolini. And I gather that was actually there when you showed up to shoot. That wasn't a prop that was brought along.
Yeah, no, it's that's Duce country up there for sure.
Let's open this to questions from the audience. Let's start towards the back in the middle there. There is a microphone with the...
The last seconds of that film when Timmy breaks the fourth wall and looks right in the camera. And I was thinking if both of you could tell us more about this breaking the fourth wall thing. Thank you.
I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. I mean...
It's an unanswerable question, because it is for any of the audience members for each of you to answer, I guess, right?
Yeah, it's like the art takes place in the head of the audience member, not on screen.
Luca, all of your films have these incredibly sensual engagement with food, and I'm not just talking about Timothy, You and the Peach, although we can discuss that later. But tell us a little bit about your use of food, and because in this one it's so vivid. Army, there's that great moment where you decapitate the egg and the yolk was kind of flowing everywhere, and there's this enormous gasping fish that's brought into the house one day. Tell us a little bit about your use of food symbolism in this, and then we can talk about the peach.
Well, in Asiman's novel, there is this kind of almost exoticism of Italy with the great food, and it goes on and on describing that. And I can only say that we try not to focus on that kind of point of view on the folklorism of food, but more about making sure that what happened on the table and the breakfast and during the scenes was what could have happened in the place, in that given place in reality. This shot belongs to another scene that we eventually cut off the movie, and that my wonderful editor brought back and put it as a punctuation. And I think the way he uses it makes the thing becomes so strong.
And Timothy, when you were playing the peach scene, I mean, obviously this is a key moment in the novel, so you must have known it was going to be in the film. And what I love about it is when you read on paper what happens, it just sounds nuts. But then in the heat of the moment, it seems completely logical. How did you get into Elio's mindset for that scene? What did you think was going through his head?
It's like, you know, sensory adaptation. So I took the night before, I took a bath with a bunch of peaches. and that was a joke, but so...
That's disappointing.
I honestly, Andre Osman, who wrote the novel, and Luca had communicated to me before we shot that scene that maybe it wasn't going to be able to make it into the movie, because maybe it just simply worked better as a literary metaphor than it could ever in a movie. And that's always a great relief as an actor, when you jump into a scene thinking, you know, if it's good, it'll make it in there, and if not, it won't. And it just seemed like, you know, no matter how silly it sounds, like just trying not to lean into any of the comedy or thinking that it's funny, or I'm not trying to, you know, have a perspective watching myself doing it, and rather just thinking, how would this actually happen? What would the experience be for, you know, a young person exploring this?
Was it the most nerve-wracking scene to shoot, or was there anything else that felt
more
difficult?
I mean, like, honestly, like the piano sequence was more nerve-wracking.
I think nerve-wracking was cycling.
Yeah, cycling, things like that. Yeah, well, Army, like, there's that amazing shot, yeah, where Army, you know, zooms by without even his hands on the handlebars. But, like, again, like the piano sequence was what I got out there early to train for and why I was out there early. So I thought on the day, like, oh, God, like, I got to show them that they didn't make a mistake. And but for the Peach stuff, again, like, it feels like kind of out there and it might not even make it in. It kind of feels like, all right, make of it what you will. And that's more exciting than anything.
Another question. Yeah, front row.
Hi there. I love the film, so thank you very much for it. I was just wondering that, so the book is really written from Elio's point of view, and he often kind of mistakes or misjudges Oliver's actions. And I was wondering how important it was for you to be able to show us Oliver's point of view, and especially like how we get to see Elio through Oliver's eyes.
Well, I think that the movie starts with Elio and grows into allowing Oliver to get into the position of the narrative as well. It's a sort of dance between these two characters, because the novel is a first single person account from a place far away from the events, and I struggle with the idea of a voiceover and stuff like that, and so it's like. I like the idea that we can dance with these two characters, and we eventually are locked with them until he goes away.
Timothy, did having that enormous block of internal monologue, even though it wasn't transposed into James's script, was that at all useful when you were preparing, or was it something you had to kind of
very useful, and I think it's always interesting when Army speaks about that, because, you know, I've heard Army say before, it's he couldn't go through the book because it's so fiercely from the point of view from Elio once we started shooting. Obviously, we both read it. In the pre-production process, even maybe to an exaggerative degree, I like to, you know, really have the character, like, almost be performing it or something. But when it comes time to doing it, you know, just let it all go. But then on the days where I'd get lost, it was like a Bible or something, because it's so clear what's going on. Like, I love the bit in the film where Oliver comes over and starts massaging Elio's shoulder, because, you know, it's a second or 2 seconds in the movie, and in the book it's a pretty, you know, long passage that's very detailed, but it was like a lot to pull from. So if anything, it was a benefit, never a constriction.
Army, did you have to go through and kind of decode what Oliver was really like from Elio's monologue?
Yeah, I mean, as Lucas said, the book is really from the, it's almost taken entirely from the interlocution of Elio. And he is a highly emotionally volatile, you know, young man. And it's very subjective also, because if Oliver came down and sat next to him at breakfast and said, you know, how was your night? Then Oliver was the greatest person in the entire world. I'm so happy he's here. But if he came down and didn't say anything and just walked out the door, then he was an asshole. So it's not exactly reliable from the, you know, in terms of building the character of Oliver. There's only a few actual lines in the book that really kind of gave me any really concrete definition of his backstory. One of which being from the phone call when he says, you know, your parents know, and he says, yeah, and he says, you're so lucky, because if my parents knew, they would send me to a correctional facility. And that was a huge hint in terms of sort of building the sense of cover in Oliver. You know, all the times that he says later, all the times that he just walks away, it's not because he's just so brashly overconfident that he just doesn't care what anybody thinks. It's because it's when the two of them are together and he's feeling something that he can't quite identify. And he doesn't know what it is, but he knows that it makes him nervous, and he knows that whatever it is, whatever's back home would never approve. So there's that little bit. And then there's also the thing about him being Jewish from the Northeast. And in my research, you know, in the early 80s, it was not an easy time to be Jewish in the Northeast. It was pretty anti-Semitic, you know. I mean, it wasn't something that you could be really public about, which is why the fact that he wears the star is also, you know, his way of kind of overcompensating in a way. So it wasn't totally reliable in terms of source material for the development of a character. But also, if you did filter it and kind of went through it through the prism of understanding that it's really the perspective of Elio, then you could kind of glean little things here and there.
One of the things that really struck me about it is Elio was obsessing over Oliver's shorts the various different colours, as I found myself doing since seeing the film. But tell us about... Right, I'm not alone, okay? Tell us about those costumes that you know...
We'll send you some of those shorts.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Tell us about the characters, you know, the costumes that they use, because they feed so much into who they are. Like the instant Oliver kind of breezes into the house with this enormous voluminous shirt.
Well, Julia Piersanti, who was our wardrobe designer, found just incredible clothing. I mean, and a lot of it is original stuff that goes back to 1983s. And a lot of the stuff that Timmy wore, correct me if I'm wrong, was her husband's stuff that was still in the closet that she was like, oh, now you're going to wear this, now you're going to wear this, now you're going to wear this. I clearly remember the first wardrobe fitting we had. I put on these shorts and they just kept going up and kept going up and kept going up. And I was like, good God. But you acclimate. And then all of a sudden you're like, I feel so free in these things. Like, these things are great. And then when I went home and put on my regular shorts, I felt like I was drowning in fabric.
Let's have another question from the audience. Great.
I must apologise for sort of waxing lyrical for a second, but I must say thank you so much for this movie. It means an incredible amount to me. Just to say to me, I never thought anybody could bring Elio to life the way that you did. He's an absolute joy on screen. To Luca, sorry, I'm taking this moment. To Luca, I'm so grateful that this movie exists. Your heart and soul is clearly in this film, so thank you so much. And Ami, you actually reduced me to tears. And the particular moment I want to ask about, it's the scene in Bergamo when Elio is asleep, and there are a few seconds of what look like negatives. And Ami, your performance afterwards, it looks like Oliver's about to break in two. It's outstanding. I just would love you to talk about what that moment in negative means.
This is a sequence with the switched colours.
Yeah, I remember. Well... the scene that you describe, that I remember, was shot as a long take. We are with Oliver, who is not naked in the real scene because we had all the square in front. And then there is Elio, and then we discover Oliver sitting on the bed. When we go on Elio, I was discussing with my editor that I like the idea to briefly have an insight in his mind, in his subconscious, in his dreams. And I won over my editor. He didn't like the idea. He thought it was out of the register of the language of the film. But we have shot a beautiful scene in the same square where Elio confesses to Oliver that he loves him, which happens in the script before they go to Bergamo, where they go back to the same monument and they climb up the monument. And I really missed the scene, and I thought maybe we should use it, and as if that is a sort of dreamt aim of Elio to be with him forever, in a way. So we used these two snippets and we made them in negative to pay homage to Scorsese's The Cape Fear. And that's it. I don't know what's the significance. It's a dream.
Another question. Yep.
It's my first time seeing the film, and I absolutely loved it. My question is, in your films, there seems to be sort of a flowing sense of sensuality and desire and sort of longing for another human being. And then there's that moment when they climb up the mountain where the waterfall is, and Armie's character looks back, and it's sort of, to me, that was sort of... look at us, we're free now, you know, nothing is holding us back. So the question is, how do you portray that on screen, this sort of sensuality, this physical desire to be with someone?
Well, I think I have great complicity with wonderful actors and friends. I think there is no other way you can reach a level of... poignancy if you don't have a team of people you work with that are capable of engaging into that kind of conversation, starting from them through my crew and head of departments. It's a mutual thing, I would say. Yeah. And thank you, because I dearly love the sequence on the waterfall. By the way, in the book, they go to Rome and they talk, they become part of a group of intellectuals, Roman intellectuals, which sounded very alluring to Asiman, being American, but because I know many of those people, I found impossible to put on the screen Italian intellectuals. And I still remember the critiques I got for the Italian Carabinieri in the biggest splash back in Italy. So I said to myself, no, I'm not going to go there. But then Ivory script took place, took them onto a tuna fishing exploration in the, because it was Sicily. And then when we went, and there was always a crowd of people. But then I thought, maybe these two want to be alone. They want to be alone. And this water you see in the Lombardian countryside comes from those mountains. So in a way, Elio is being so thoughtful of bringing him to the origin of the water of the region. And I thought it was great. So that's what we did.
And to answer your question about the moment in the waterfall where I turn around, it was a crazy day. We had to all, you know, everybody carry equipment up this massive mountain to get it all up there, because there was no roads and it wasn't even actually a waterfall. It was a hydroelectric dam that they could open the water for once. And right before we shot it, they said, okay, open the dam. And they said, it'll be about 10 minutes before the water comes out. And Luca goes, okay, I want you to think about the possibilities of impossibility. And I went, what? And he goes, I want you to think about the possibilities of impossibility. And I was like, wait, hold on, I don't understand. He goes, just do it. Boom. And he hit me, like, hard, like, kind of like this. And it just stunned me. And then he turned around and walked down the mountain. And then the water started to fall, and they said, action. And I kind of turned around, like, I think he just hit me.
And I was terrified, because I thought, now he's coming back, and he's going to hit me back. But if he hits me back, I'm done.
And I was just thinking, ooh.
Just at the end of that sequence, there's at the train station, after Elio's said goodbye to Oliver and he makes the phone call back to his to his mother. It's one of a few moments in the film where there is a kind of a figure just there in the frame who hasn't anything to do with what's going on, but it's an old lady who's sitting towards the back of the railway station. And, you know, throughout the film, in the Bergamo sequences as well, there are people sort of milling around, and it's kind of hard to know whether they've been cast or whether they're just kind of, you know, there through happenstance. Who were they?
That was an idea I had. I asked it for an old lady, and we found the right one, and we put it there. I gave it, I'm serious, I put the fan on her. She was great. She didn't know what she was doing, but she was fantastic.
But the old lady where we go and there's the picture of Mussolini and she's sitting there peeling beans, she just happened to be there, right?
No, she is the owner of the house, but once we made the scouting and we decided to shoot there and leave Duce Mussolini over there, we also asked her to be there, and okay, we gave her beans to snack.
I thought that was a really organic moment. I just went up to this old lady and started peeling beans with her. And I was like, this is amazing. Now it's all fake.
Let's have another question from the audience. There in the middle. Yes, yep.
Okay, the Jewish thing is really interesting to me for an obvious reason. But it's so nice to see Jewish people in a film. Subtle, chic, ordinary, not over the top, just people. Nothing to do with being Jewish. They just were Jewish. It was charming. And I know this is a bit strange, but I started wearing my stuff after the film. Oh. I got no idea why. I'm an old lady. I'm straight. I love this film. I just started wearing it.
And why, I will, why are you, say, here?
Huh? Bravo and grazie. Okay. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
There was another question, yeah, in the yellow top in the dungarees, just a few rows now.
Hello. I wanted to mention the music in the film, but specifically the physical embodiment of that music, especially Army's scene, you know, with the dancing. And Timmy as well. You did a lot of like slides and stuff. So I just want to also heard that you, the final scene, you had like an earpiece that had visions of Gideon playing. So I just wanted to like explore music in the film and how that affected your performances.
I really love that question. It really has so little to do with me besides that final scene, and it's all thanks to Luca. But I mean, I love just going through the movie and seeing that there's Bach and Ravel and this classical music, and then there's the new music from Sofjan Stevens, but also Talking Heads and Psychedelic Furs. It's really like a total testament to Luca's genius and his ability to mend these songs together. Speaking to that last scene, again, that was Luca's idea, where he said it's probably going to be a 3-4 minute take because we're going to want the credits to be rolling over it, so I think you should have the song playing. And then, like, it, you know, I don't know what it would have been to not have it. I wouldn't have been able to time it as well, and it almost became like an acting exercise of sorts, where it felt like channel whatever's going on in the song. And like, that song has its own arc that in the tone of nostalgia really relates to the movie too, and he keeps asking if it's a video, if it's like a memory, if it's something that's played out on screen. That's a soundbite I stole from you.
Luca, tell us about Sufjan Stevens' involvement in the film. Was he someone that you always thought this is going to be the guy who can really bring something to this with some new songs, or did you look at using purely existing music from him?
No, it starts with the idea of the novel with the fact that the novel is told in first person singular, and in James' script there was still some remnants of this voiceover of Elio, which I wanted to really not use because I didn't thought it was the right in terms of tone. But I had a sort of fascination with the idea of the omniscient narrator, like the voice of Thackeray in Barry Lyndon, for instance, or Edith Wharton in The Age of Innocence, or the magnificent Amberson. And one day I will do that. So I started to think, like, maybe instead of having the narrator, we could have someone punctuating the narration with little songs and maybe some little phrases showing up during the interrupting the action. And I know it's crazy, but I know that's not the movie you saw, but that was the origin of it. And I always loved Sufjan. I think he's a fantastic artist. His music, lyrics, voice is all combined in such a aching poetry. It's so beautiful, and is also his face is so open. There is such an openness in his face. So I called him and said, "Listen, would you like to do the narrator of the movie? Come up and I shoot you to a couple of times, and you say something, and then maybe you sing a song." I said, "No way." And the phone call was like, boom, no way. So I called again and I said, "Okay, no narration, but would you make a song for the film?" And he said, "Yeah, that I can do." And we started talking of one of his songs, which is Futile Devices, which in terms of the lyrics is incredibly adherent to the film. It's really fantastic. Like, it seems like written from after having read the book or seen the film. And I said, we spoke about that, we spoke about Elian Oliver, we spoke about the movie. And then a few months later and a few calls later, we were shooting the film, and it was like an afternoon in which we'd wrap early, I guess. We were in my living room and we were resting, and I got an email from Sufjan. And there were three songs. One was a rearranging of Futile Devices for piano, so that the universe of the instrument was close to Elio, and then those two great, great, great songs. I mean, I remember we were astonished because those songs are really great, like beyond, like fantastic. And then we played them and we were like, wow. And me and Walter, my editor, immediately knew where to put them. And so you had the song for you to think about for the ending for many weeks.
And now that sadly is the ending of today's Q&A. But to all our panellists, Luca, Timothy and Army, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.